This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome, everyone, to The Infinite Consciousness this week. This is Eva Herr, and thanks for listening. Tonight we have with us Dr. Jim Oshman, and we're going to talk about ASEEM, the International Society for the Study of Subtle Energy and Energy Medicine, and Jim's new book and the work that he's doing with energy medicine. How are you, Jim?
Well, I'm just fine. Thank you.
Before we get started, why don't you tell everybody a little bit about you so they'll know who you are and where you're coming from?
I began life as an academic scientist. I studied cell biology and biophysics and published scientific papers for many years. And about 25 years ago, I became very interested in alternative medicine at a time when this was not exactly the very exciting field that it has become recently. And I did a lot of exploration of various schools of therapeutics, and I discovered that they were very interested in finding a scientific basis for their work. And I'm talking here about acupuncture, all the therapies from A to Z, acupuncture to zero balancing, polarity therapy, Reiki, osteopathy, and on, chiropractic, and so on. All these methods that are not taught in medical schools, but are increasingly becoming a major part of our healthcare system. And so that's how I got started. I began by bringing a scientific perspective to therapeutic schools that really were very interested but didn't know that there was any science that would support their work. And it turns out that in the realm of energy, there's a lot of science that's been done. And in fact, there's a whole field of energy medicine, and it is it has applications to all therapeutic approaches, including all of the Western medical traditions as well.
I'm curious, how did your peers accept you when you got into this?
It turned out that most scientists in the past have been kind of skeptical, which is fine because that's part of science, is to be skeptical. My peers actually became the therapists. I began lecturing and giving workshops for schools all over the world, and I learned a great deal from them, and my real passion is to take that information back to the scientific community. Because it turns out that people who do different kinds of hands-on therapy every day, people who touch people every day, have very interesting experiences. And biomedicine needs to know about those experiences. It's different when you work on a whole human being as opposed to working on some cells or molecules isolated in a test tube. And
Absolutely.
Those two realms of the test tube science and the hands-on science, and I consider it science, fit together and are enabling us to put together a clearer picture of what life is and what the human body is. And also, related to your passion, what consciousness is.
Absolutely. We're going to talk a lot about that. I spent some time today with a NASA physicist friend of mine, and we've got some questions we want to ask you.
Oh, good.
Also, before we get started, too, I promised Christine Page that we would talk a little bit about ASEEM because their conference is coming up this month, and you have been with ASEEM forever and ever and helped get them going and know probably as much as anybody about that, so if you would share a little bit about that, I'd appreciate it.
This is a wonderful group of people. I learned about the formation of this organization way back at the beginning, and so I'm a founding member. I joined right away. The goal was to bring science and spirituality together And this seemed like a very good thing to be thinking about and working on. And subsequently, I've met lots of incredible people. The thing about ISEEM is that everyone feels comfortable because there are physicists, engineers, massage therapists, physicians, people who are just curious. It's quite a cross-section of people and a cross-section of interests, and it's a very stimulating environment. It's a stimulating meeting. This year we're having some very exciting people present, as is always the case. Some of the people that I consider to be the leaders in the field come there, and you can talk to them, and some of them give workshops where you get to have personal interactions with the people who are really laying the foundation for the future of medicine and beyond, to the subject that you're very passionate about, the nature of consciousness and what it is we all need to know about consciousness and the science behind consciousness. So it's an exciting group and a very warm group of people. And I'm looking forward to this year's meeting. Some people are coming that I've never met, but I've known about their work for a long time, and I'm excited to hear what they have to say.
Yeah, I think they've got John Hagelin, and I know Amit Goswami is coming. Matthew Fox is coming, so that'll be interesting to have a religious speaker there, you know, to tie in what's normally the science that they use.
Well,
but it's definitely the cutting edge.
I've known about John Hagelin for a long time because I've been fascinated, believe it or not, with levitation. And he has done a lot of work in that field. He's a quantum physicist, and he has also spent a lot of time with Maharishi, and they have looked at the physics, the quantum physics, from the spiritual perspective as well as the scientific perspective. So that's quite exciting for me, because I think that the physics, the modern physics and quantum physics, has lessons for us, for all of us, really, that are really important in these times when our interconnectedness, the fact that we really can't be safe unless everyone is safe on the planet, for
That's
just
right.
as an example. And this is an issue related to consciousness and related to the way we envision the future of humanity and the future of life on Earth. So these are profound questions, and they really affect everyone.
Well, this conference, just for my listening audience, is June the 21st through the 22nd. It's in Boulder, Colorado. Their website is www.isseem.org. So check it out. Try to make it. It's a wonderful conference and absolute cutting-edge technology information for you. So
actually, the dates are the 21st to the 25th of June, and then there are two post-conference workshops with remarkable people who will be presenting after the regular meeting.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So why don't we start off by just asking the fundamental question of what is your definition of consciousness so we can all be on the same page about what we're talking about?
I'm not ready to define consciousness. It's a topic that has fascinated me for a long time, and it's a topic that I am right now working on. I've had some breakthrough insights, that I can talk about. It's a subject that is actually the history of the study of consciousness is interesting. For a long time, scientists were not supposed to talk about it. It was sort of off limits. It was for the philosophers and for those with a spiritual perspective, but it was not considered a scientific topic until one of the great scientists, Francis Crick, who was a Nobel laureate. He and James Watson discovered the double helix. And Francis Crick, in his prestigious position, began to talk about the science of consciousness. And many scientists around the world felt that they could now feel safe talking about consciousness. And that started a whole new surge of interest and discussion, and a journal, a scientific journal, the Journal of Consciousness Studies, and a lot of people who have been thinking about consciousness for a long time started to publish articles. What is consciousness? My definition divides consciousness into two parts. And the ordinary part, I say ordinary because it's neurological consciousness. It's what you are using during our discussion, your nervous system. You are taking in my words, you're hearing them with your ears, and you're processing the words with your nervous system and attempting to determine what meaning they might have for you and how they fit in with your scheme of things. So that's neurological consciousness, and that's our everyday consciousness. And it's how we know the world and how we think about the world and how we decide what to do next through our thoughtful processes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another kind of consciousness, and it has been called the subconscious, but that's not been a very very valuable approach to consciousness from the scientific perspective, because the scientists want to know, what is that? Where is that? What is? Give me some facts. Give me something I can touch and I can put in the test tube. And
yeah, I feel like I don't mean to interrupt you, but I feel like I have to ask lots of questions here, because I've been doing a project where I've been interviewing the leading scientists around the world about this, and I find that some of them think that consciousness is simply awareness. Some of them think that consciousness is what Lynn MacTaggart and some of us call the field, you know, everything that exists as we know it and as we don't know it. So I might have to interject a few questions. And when you talk about subconscious, are you talking about individualized subconscious? Or
is it the
whole picture of with what we call God, maybe?
The way I came about this was through my considerations of energy medicine and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And really our awareness of the world is about the energies that surround us. All of our sensory systems are sensing energies, such as light and heat and sound and touch, vibration, and so on. So we build up our picture of the world in that way. But it turns out that only the stronger elements, energetic elements in our environment, reach nervous system. The nervous system has a filter at the beginning, at the very beginning of the receptor. You can call it the sensorium. It's when I sit here, I am sensing all of those different energies in my environment. And the less intense signals, the lower energies, the subtle energies, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I asked this interesting question. What do we do with that information? Do we ignore that? In other words, does the sensory system ignore very subtle things that are going on around us that are too weak to activate the nervous system? And the answer, as a biologist, the answer is no. Biology is very efficient. Life is very efficient. Life does not waste information. So I developed the picture that we are really taking in much more information from our environment than we realize neurologically. And it goes to a place which is called the unconscious, but it really is our bodies. It goes into the matrix that forms the structure of our bodies. And I've defined what that matrix is. It's a continuous system that extends throughout the body. It's actually the largest organ of the body. I call it the living matrix. And it extends into every cell and every nucleus. The genetic material is part of that matrix. And in my writings and my lectures and workshops, I am discussing the idea that that matrix, that really is the fabric of our living system, is where the subconscious is. And it takes in an enormous amount of information, but that information is not available to us consciously, to our nervous system, except under extraordinary circumstances, which are kind of intuitions. And in our culture, we tend to disregard intuition. And I believe, as some thinkers have stated, that intuition is actually far more accurate than thoughtful analysis, because it's based on a lot more information, all that subtle information.
And when just some of our listeners, because we have to assume that the listeners don't know anything about this. So when you say that we take in a lot more information, you're not just talking about information that we see, television and our children in the background. There's information that's coming in that we can't see, that we aren't aware of through, I guess, frequencies or electromagnetic, something.
Actually, this whole thing that I'm talking about only shows up every now and then when something mysterious happens. We catch little glimpses of this out of the corners of our eyes. For example, you go to step off the curb and something says, wait. And then the bus goes by that you weren't looking for. And you realize that something inside of you sensed that you shouldn't step off the curb. And it saved your life. This is one example. Mm-hmm. Another example is, have you ever had the experience of time slowing down? Like in a crisis situation, or maybe not such a crisis, but it happens with people who are in automobile accidents, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very common. Time slows down. What does that mean? And in exploring that, I have realized that what is happening is the consciousness clock is speeding up, so that every second is divided into, instead of 10 or 20 units of now and then now and then now, it's divided into 100 or 1,000 units, giving you plenty of time to react in a life or death situation. What is that all about? Many people have had that experience of time slowing down and of having detailed recall of the events that took place during, say, an accident. And this is a big clue about the nature of consciousness. So I look at these occasional glimpses we get of another dimension, another reality, and I believe that we can explain and understand these phenomena, and we can do that in a way that sheds light on a bigger picture of consciousness. And basically what I'm saying is we need to have a holistic picture, and our picture tends to be neurological. We have a nervous system. Yes, the nervous system and the brain develop an awareness of the world and a thoughtful processing of information and decisions about what to do next. And we have that, but there's another system. And it's a deeper system, and we're not usually aware of that system, except in extraordinary circumstances. And that's the system that I'm exploring. It turns out that athletes and other performers are very interested in that system because it is the system that comes to the fore when the athlete is about to do a fantastic performance. It's a state of consciousness, of awareness of everything, and the body being totally connected to itself. I refer to this as systemic cooperation. It's really a state of consciousness that every athlete knows about. They refer to it as the zone. It's a state of consciousness where you know that you are going to have a very good performance, whatever it is you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm exploring the zone and what that state of consciousness is. And I believe it's a clue about the nature of consciousness and this other system. For example, athletes do things when they're at their peak of performance that are too fast to be explained by the nervous system. They sense and respond to the world around them in a way that you just can't explain by normal sensory motor. You know, you sense the brain sees the world, thinks about it, decides what to do. No, it's too fast
for
that.
That's, and what you mean by that is that the nervous system and those kind of responses are more chemical, right? So there's got to be something magnetic or something going on. Is that what you mean? Some of our listeners will understand.
I wouldn't describe it that way. The nervous system does have, for example, it does have chemical communication involved mm-hmm. in synapses. And synapses are places where one neuron touches upon another, and the signal jumps from one nerve to another and to another. And you can measure, synapses actually delay things. It takes a while for a synapse to function. And you mm-hmm. can measure how quick a response is if you count the number of synapses. For example, reflexes. You touch the hot stove and you pull your fingers away. You pull your hand away from the hot stove. That's a reflex. And there is a monosynaptic reflex. There's only one synapse. The sensory nerve that senses the heat synapses directly on the muscle that pulls your hand away. And that's a very fast kind of responding. But most responses are a lot slower because there are more synapses involved, and each synapse involves a delay. So neuroscience has developed a very nice picture of how we sense and respond to the world, and I'm suggesting that there's another way of sensing and responding to the world. And it's in terms of energy, in terms of the energetics, we are all tuning into the energies of our environment all the time through our various sensors. And I'm suggesting that very low, subtle energies are enter our system and are remembered and processed. And one of the places where this processing occurs is in dreams. That's just one example.
Mm-hmm. So What do you believe to be the source of these intentions?
Well, intention is another subject of great interest. It's a big subject, and it's a philosophical.
What sends the signals? I mean, what is the energy behind the signal? The signals down below the quantum level. Where does it come from?
There are two kinds of behavior, as far as I can see. There is thoughtful behavior, where you decide now is the time to go and get a glass of water. So you respond to your inner environment and the world around you by going and getting a glass of water and drinking it. And that's a neurological process. And there's another kind of sensing and responding, which I refer to as being authentic. It's different from thoughtful. It arises spontaneously. And this is what happens with the athlete in the middle of the Super Bowl. The quarterback throws the ball and it goes to the receiver in the end zone, even though the quarterback can't see that person he's throwing the ball to, and everyone is trying to knock him down and so on. It's quite an exciting, high-energy situation. And yet, out of all of that, the athlete is able to sense at a subtle level everything that's going on and do the perfect performance, to perform absolutely at the peak. Now, I don't know if this is getting to the question that you're asking.
Well, I just think of, there has got to be a source of information, an original intention from somewhere that sends these impulses. And I'm curious how that source conveys its, I guess what I'm talking about is God. How does it convey its message to a human being's brain? Through signaling, I guess. And so what makes those signals go?
Well, I have a picture of that, and it doesn't necessarily refer to God, because I know that there are many spiritual traditions that are different, and they all have something in common, though. And there is such a thing, I believe, as people being in alignment with their destiny, with the things that they were brought here to do. And this is a very wonderful state of being when you find that the work you do and the life you lead is tremendously exciting and tremendously rewarding, and it's as though the universe lines up to support you. And you could call that you have God behind you, or you could call it, you could refer to angels supporting you,
right.
Or you could refer to it as, there are many different ways of describing it, but I'm talking about this as being what I've described as authentic. It's not arising 100% from thought. It's arising from some other source. And this is what happens when people change the world. I believe, for example, that this discussion you've begun about consciousness can be world-changing. It can be. This is a profound discussion that you have initiated here, and that it can affect many different aspects of the world for many people. So I'm proud of you for bringing this up, for your enthusiasm about exploring consciousness, because you, I think, Eva, are, you know you have to do this. This is your path.
Drives me crazy, Jim. I swear it drives me crazy.
It gets you up in the middle of the night, and it keeps you going when any logical-minded person would say, why are you doing that?
And
but
they do say that.
You have to do it. They do say that?
Yes. Broke
so you
marriage.
Know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do.
This is coming from some source, and I wouldn't put a name on it. It does have to do with energy in the sense that it involves you as an energetic being, and it can provide you with energy. You can wake up at 3 a.m. and dive into it. And I'm excited that you're doing this, Eva, and I'm excited to look at your very nice website and see that you are planning to synthesize the information from the various people that you have been talking with on this program, and I look forward to that. This is very desirable to get the pieces of a puzzle and look at them and see how they fit together. And I think out of this is going to come something very exciting.
That brings me one of the questions that I've asked a lot of people. In fact, I sent Bill Tiller and Amit Goswami this question this week, and I got two distinctly different answers, and I think it's important that we figure out a way to all get on the same page. First of all, we know that information's got to be conveyed some way. How is it? We think that it's signaling, you know, if you look at HeartMath's work, encoded in frequencies, but with like kind of like the Morse code. What do you think about that?
Well, the HeartMath work is really fascinating, and I admire them for their determination and their careful research that they're doing. And one of the studies that fascinated me the most, recent work that Roland McCready and his colleagues have done, shows that the mind, whatever that is continually scanning into the future.
So let's back up a minute. What do you think that is? Because people have different opinions. Some people think mind is brain.
Well, that's what Francis Crick said when he got the whole field going again, when he got scientists interested in consciousness, and he made a statement that consciousness arises from the massive interconnectedness of millions of neurons in the brain. And it's as though the brain is the mind, is a computer. And that model really hasn't stood up very well. I don't really think that mind and consciousness reside in the brain. And I have some important people who agree with that. For example, Carl Jung said psyche is not in the brain or in the mind. Well, that's an interesting statement. He's a very thoughtful student of what consciousness is. And in relation to the communication, Jung was very interested in synchronicity, which is a fascinating subject.
Mm-hmm.
You think of your friend, and the phone rings, and there's your friend. Or you think of your friend, and you go out to the mailbox, and after years of not having any contact, there's a letter. And you think, gosh, I haven't thought about that person for years. And I thought about that person, and here's a letter. And Jung said this is something that happens. This is not coincidence. This is a form of communication. And one of the fascinating stories related to that is that the great quantum physicist Wolfgang Pauli, who got the Nobel Prize for his foundational work in quantum mechanics, Pauli was a patient of Carl Jung. And they got to talking about synchronicity, and Polly had discovered this extraordinary phenomenon called the exclusion principle, the Polly exclusion principle. And the gist of the whole thing is that particles in relationship with each other, if you separate them, they remain in communication with each other. So you can take, and this was demonstrated experimentally, you can take electrons and that are in a relationship with each other. For example, they're in the same atom or the same part of an atom, and you can shoot them apart from each other at the speed of light, and they remain in communication with each other, such that if one of them has its spin inverted, the other one immediately inverts its spin, and they are communicating, even though they are moving apart from each other, at twice the speed of light. One's going speed of light in one direction, and the other's going speed of light in the other direction, and they're in communication with each other. And this is a deep level of communication, and it takes us to a, well, of course, Carl Jung was very interested in that, and Jung and Polly wrote a book together, remarkably. It's a rather rare book, but there it is. They did discuss these things, and it shows a level of connection, a connectedness that exists in the quantum realm that we don't normally experience unless our friend is ill and we pray for them, even though they're 1,000 miles away. So prayer and distant healing are part of a lot of the different healing schools. It's been discovered that the work that you can do in Reiki or therapeutic touch or polarity therapy or any of another of dozens of different therapeutic approaches, the work you can do on a person, you can also do on a person who's 1,000 miles away. And
that
this
brings
is telling
up another
us
question.
Something. Yeah, go
do
ahead.
Do you think that, two questions I have actually. Do you think that when that electron or proton or whatever it is, it starts oscillating and sending out information? My first question is, does it send and receive at the same time? And my second question is, how much ever force that you put in it, intention or charge, whatever you want to call it, if you put a lot, does it send out a lot? And if you put a little bit, does it send out a little bit? I mean, the more you do it, the stronger the effect. Does that make any sense?
Well, definitely you can practice these things. Jung said you can practice synchronicity. You can get good at it. Anything you practice, anything you do again and again, the channels open up and become more reliable. As far as the when things communicate, one of the great quantum physicists, David Bohm, described a phenomenon called the quantum potential. And he said that when those two electrons, for example, are speeding apart from each other, and you change one and then the other one changes instantaneously, he said the way we look at that normally is that a message has been sent. The one electron flips and a message goes through space to the other electron and it flips. And he suggested maybe that's not the way to look at it. Maybe when the one electron flips, it changes the properties of space everywhere, mm-hmm. instantaneously, everywhere. And so the other electron picks that up. And that's a very interesting idea. And it turns out that there is a physics that describes a type of signaling that is, and I have to put that signaling in quotation marks because it's not really a signal. as in a message that goes from point A to point B. It's not that when I pray for or intend to heal my friend who's 1,000 miles away, it's not that some wave propagates through space from me to them. No, that's not what's happening. What is happening is that my act of prayer or healing or compassion affects the properties of space everywhere. And because my friend happens to be living in the same space that I'm living in, they benefit from that. And it's a slightly different perspective. It's not a communication system where from A to B. And this is what McCrady was talking about when he described this incredible, and he demonstrated this very reliably, that the mind is scanning the future. And how this works, he said, is that, and it turns out that the sensor of the future, in his studies, remarkably, is the heart. It's not the brain, it's the heart. The heart picks up what is going to happen before the brain knows about it. And what he said was, the heart's field is interacting with some fundamental field of the universe that has information that is not bounded by space and time. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, actually, Roland and I have had some conversations about it. We know that
Good.
It's sent in signaling like rat-a-tat-tat, rat-a-tat-tat, you know, like Morse code kind of things. We're hoping to use my ability maybe to figure out the timing in between those individual signals. Because if
That's
we could,
good.
then we could figure out, you know, if disease is impending, you know, just by measuring some kind of signaling. It's just figuring out the timing in that signaling. And now that we're talking about disease, I want you to talk a minute. I hate to get off this topic of consciousness because I love it, but I want to go talk about your paper that you sent me and the living matrix and how cells store memories, possibly everything that we've ever encountered in our entire life, and some of your techniques like EFT, the tapping that you've talked about. We've got about 20 minutes or so. I'm going to have you back, Jim, if you'll come.
Well, thank you. These are very exciting techniques. They are revolutionizing the field of psychotherapy. And, of course, some psychotherapists are object to this as an approach. It's new and it's different. And other psychotherapists are adopting it and are delighted with the kinds of results they're getting. But it has to do with trauma. And the paper I sent you has to do with trauma. And I'm fascinated with trauma. I believe that it relates to your topic of consciousness. It relates to the ability of all of us to be able to follow our destiny, to do the things that are rewarding for us and that change the world in a way that we would like the world to change. So trauma, it's hard to really have an exciting life and to do the things that you feel you were brought here to do if you're in pain or if you're suffering from some event that happened 20 years ago. And these events actually give rise to stress and disorders and even eventually disease. And it turns out that most disease has an emotional basis. And I would have found that an extraordinary thing to say a few years ago, but now I've seen enough examples of people being healed from really serious diseases by simple techniques that help them resolve old traumas, old emotional memories. So this is a very big subject. It's important for all of us as individuals, but even more important, it's important for our life on the planet because there's a lot of trauma going on in the world. A lot of people are suffering, and as I said right at the beginning when we started talking, in a world where there is terror and people who really want to do damage to our way of life, none of us can really be safe until all of us are safe. So events taking place in the Middle East and other places around the world where people do not have an opportunity to live in peace, they seem far away, and they aren't.
And no, they're not.
Quantum mechanics says that everything is connected, and, you know, Fritjof Capra wrote a book, The Turning Point, fascinating book, in which he said that the realization of our interconnectedness has really arrived, and it affects all branches of endeavor. Bankers discover, a banker in Savannah, Georgia, discovers that what his bank can do depends on things that are going on in Brazil. So the financial system is totally interconnected worldwide, and that's true of the healthcare system, and it's true of political systems, and on and on and on. And
this I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Do you think we live in a holographic environment?
The holographic model is a very good description, and I think it applies. It applies to us as individuals, and it applies to us. There are ideas that the whole universe is a hologram, and I think that that's kind of the picture that Roland McCready was getting in his research, that the heart can tune into events distant in time and space, and information about things that have happened or that will happen is available to us. And this is not part of Newtonian mechanics. You know, the mechanics of the physics that has led to the Industrial Revolution and has made successful automobile engines and so on, that physics is real and it works, and you can make an automobile and it does work. And quantum mechanics says that that physics isn't wrong, it's just that there's something else going on at a deeper level.
Right,
and that's what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Do you think intention creates, or that thought creates mass?
Creates
mass? Or
what
we know as mass? Including, when I say that, I mean, because mass in the physical reality is also mass in your body, such as tumors and cancers and plaque in your arteries.
Well, there's definitely, in fact, one of my colleagues said, some people say there's no such thing as energy medicine, where the physicists are telling us there is nothing else in the universe except energy. So when you realize that matter, mass, is really, fundamentally, energy, that's one piece of the answer to your question. And then where does consciousness come in?
Mm-hmm.
And the perspective that comes from quantum physics, and by the way, also seems to be congruent with some of the philosophies of Tibetan Buddhism and other spiritual traditions and the ancient wisdoms, is that consciousness lies underneath all of it.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as being able to create mass with your consciousness, I think that's one of the things that John Hagelin will talk about at the ICEME meeting, because his work that I have read on gravity and on levitation levitation is accomplished remarkably, he said in his writings, by going with your consciousness down to those low levels where the laws of physics are formed. It's not that the laws of physics are permanent, unviolable, you know. They arise from consciousness. So mm-hmm. there's a deeper level that can be reached where the laws of physics can be redone. And this enables levitation to take place.
That's amazing.
And other things.
That's amazing.
So I would say the answer to your question is yes, consciousness and energy can coalesce to create matter, and sculptors do it every day.
I'm going to ask you something that's like totally off what we're saying, but you made me think about it right now. When you think about the zero-point field, you know, everything on one side of the zero-point field is where all the mass is and where all the light is. And on the other side of the zero-point field, there's no mass. There's just pure energy. Do you think perhaps that could be the dividing line between duality in the dual world? You know what I mean?
It does appear to be that's the case. That's a very good description, I think, of the situation. There's one physicist who has thought deeply about the so-called quantum vacuum or zero-point energy, Mark Cummings. And he's described, he refers to the quantum plenum. It's a plenty. It's an abundance.
Mm-hmm.
What we used to think was empty space, a vacuum, is a richness, a fullness, containing a vast amount of information and energy. And I think this is what Roland McCready is referring to when he says the mind is scanning into the future and the heart is interacting with a field. This is the field of the quantum plenum, which mm-hmm. has information. It's rich in information. These are fantastic ideas, by the way, that are coming from physics and from thoughtful people who are looking at physics in relation to consciousness. These ideas, and for many, their first reaction will be great skepticism, but I view these as very optimistic perspectives. They help us see how we really have a lot more ability to affect the world than we give ourselves credit for.
Absolutely.
And that's where I think your exploration of consciousness it will be headed, in part to help people get an expanded idea of who they are and what they are.
And the power they have.
Exactly. We put ourselves in a little box and we say, this is who I am and this is what I can do. And I love the statement that a single determined person can change the world.
Look at Oprah Winfrey.
In fact, that's the only way the world ever changes, is by single individuals who are really determined, and they're usually, by the way, women.
I hate to say it, but that's kind of true. Well, I didn't get to cover near the stuff I wanted to cover on your paper, but I would like for you, we've got just about a minute and a half, I'd like for you to tell the people where they can find you, what the name of your book is, your website, because it's very, very interesting work, Jim.
Well, thank you. My book is Energy Medicine, The Scientific Basis. That was the first book. And it has been a big success because the healthcare system worldwide is shifting. And there are a lot of techniques that involve energy that have in the past been regarded as sort of lower class, less important, perhaps skeptical techniques that are gaining in popularity because of their effectiveness and
mm-hmm.
because they rarely have any side effects. And people like these different therapies, and there are a lot of devices coming along, energy medicine devices that can scan your body and diagnose what's going on with you and treat you with using very subtle kinds of energy. So I wrote about the science, and a lot of people thought there wasn't any science, and there is. There's quite a bit of science. My book is a success because I have listened to therapists. I've listened to their experiences, and then I've tried to fit their experiences together with the science that's in the library. And it's been a very educational, it's been a very fun process, and it enables me to go back to the different therapists and say, look, there's this science here. What do you think of this? And it helps them to understand what they're doing and refine their methods.
And where can
people more
find
effective.
You? Find your book?
Oh, Amazon has my books, and the Barnes & Noble and Borders, and the publisher is world's largest publisher, actually. It's Elsevier. So it's easy to get the books. The second book is Energy Medicine and Therapeutics and Human Performance, and that book came about because I learned that elite athletes, are very interested in energy medicine and energy. They know that the difference between a gold medal and a silver medal can be just a thousandth of a percent of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're really fascinated with how they can develop their own energetic systems so that they can be more effective.
And what's
my
your website?
Yeah, that's energyresearch.us. One word, energyresearch.us. And I give lectures and workshops really all over the world. I went, and that's an indication of how much interest there is in this work. I went to Asia twice and to Europe three times last year. I've been to Europe four times already this year, and I'm going again this week. I'm going to Germany. And then the week following will be the ICEM meeting, which is very exciting, and I'm giving an all-day workshop at the ICEM meeting about energy medicine.
Well, I have to apologize. I really wanted to spend this whole hour focusing on what you've been doing, but you've had so much information, I've been all over the board, so promise me you'll come back.
Okay.
Because I'd love to have you. I mean, I could just pick your brain for the next two or three weeks, I think. Thanks, Jim, and please do come back. And everybody go and see Jim at ICEM. He'll be there. It's a great conference. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week. Good night, Jim.
Good night. We'll see you, Eva.
All righty. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.